The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution.
Dear friends, good afternoon. On behalf of the American University Washington College of Law, I want to welcome everyone to this luncheon for today's conference on realizing the promise of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Examining the field the first 60 years and beyond. This conference marks an important occasion to reflect upon the progress made since the inception of the Universal Declaration, as well as to identify ways in which to overcome the challenges that have thus far prevented full realization of the fundamental values enshrined in the Declaration. We are fortunate today to have with us Dean Harold Koh of Yale Law School as our keynote speaker in this event co-sponsored by the American Society of International Law. The American Society is a powerful voice to explore the theory and practice in international law and is an important strategic partner for all of us who want to pursue together important values of human dignity. The address of Dean Koh today will be on the politics of implementation, the role of human rights in foreign policy. And this is a vital topic that presents time, but today is very important in particular because we're living in a moment of transition. And we have the opportunity to discuss in one of our panels today the issue of implementation and analyze how relevant remains the role of horizontal supervision and what activities, endeavors continue today to rest on the hands of governments who are the most important actors on the international community. Dean Koh has extensive experience and scholarship to bear on the topic. In addition to serving as Dean of Yale Law School since 2004, where he began teaching in 1995, he is the Gerald C. and Bernice Latrobe Smith Professor of International Law. He's a leading expert of international law. I think most of us learn his analysis on the ways in which the transnational legal process unfolds. And we all have learned much on how the vision resting upon only state actors doesn't do justice to the possibilities and opportunities that international law offers to influence behavior and to be influenced also by multiple actors in the international community. I think his work on the transnational legal process has been crucial for the teaching of law to understanding dynamic processes and for the field of human rights. He served also as U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labor from 1998 to 2001. And it would be enough to say that we have had very few individuals in that position that receive the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights, and not only that, engage in co-conspirational activities to promote the important values. I still remember the accessibility of Harold Koh and a conference in the General Assembly that took place in Costa Rica, where not such a good meal, we were thinking as to what we could do to promote important values and what role the United States and other countries could perform in that endeavor. And I think all of us were impressed not only by the talking, but by the doing of the time that Harold Koh was in that important position. He served in the Office of Legal Counsel of the Department of Justice between 1993 and 1995, following a year in private practice, and has appeared before the United States Supreme Court on numerous occasions, while previously he served as a clerk for Justice Harris Blackmun. Again, his endeavors to influence through litigation decisions by the court have been very important for him. His role on the issues of refugees, the reach of U.S. laws, and the definition of jurisdiction. I think all these type of things have been very important for all of structure. Again, his experiences, advocacy, and academic pursuits are inextricably linked to both the legal and political reality of the implementation and protection of human rights, and has been very important for all of us to try to pursue policies, cases that will have an impact and do justice in individual cases. He's the author of many publications, 8 books, and his book on the National Security Constitution was awarded the American Political Science Association's Award on the Best Book on the American Presidency in 1991. Tim Cole has been named one of America's 45 leading public sector lawyers under the age of 45 by American Lawyer Magazine and one of the 100 most influential Asian Americans by the 1990s magazine. He has also been recognized on numerous occasions for his outstanding contributions to the legal community. Among his many awards, including those for his work in human rights work, Tim Cole received the 2005 Louis Son Award from the American Bar Association International Law Section and the 2003 Wolfgang Eggman Award from Columbia Law School for his lifetime achievement in international law. It's a tremendous honor to have the report here to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here, and now I know why I feel so tired. Claudio is a great friend and a great role model. In fact, he is a person with whom I regularly talk about how you can be a dean in the day and work on human rights issues at night, and he has been a role model all the way through. Grossman, as you know, means great man, and I don't think that that's an accident. I also want to thank Betsy Anderson and the American Society of International Law for co-hosting this event. We are now at 60 years since the adoption of the Universal Declaration, and most of us have come to maturity under its protection, and this conference is, I think, expressing a very important set of ideas about how to continue the path that was set in those first 60 years. I wanted to talk about that document, harkening back to the words of the prayer which Eleanor Roosevelt said every night, which is also the title of Marianne Glendon's book on the subject, A World Made New. She said, "Our Father, who has set a restlessness in our hearts, made us all seekers after that which we can never fully find. Forbid us to be satisfied with what we make of life. Save us from ourselves and show us a vision of a world made new." That was the promise of the Universal Declaration 60 years ago, and that remains its promise today, not fulfilled, but striving after it, and a vision of a better world that we seek. And I wanted to suggest that the time since the Universal Declaration was adopted can really be thought of as falling into 4 distinct eras. Many think that there has been no progress, but in fact there were 4 eras which I would call the era of universalization, the era of institutionalization, the era of operationalization, and the era of globalization, which is the era in which we now live. And since I like to subdivide things, I break that into a period after the fall of the Berlin Wall till the fall of the Twin Towers, which is a period of optimism about globalization, followed by the 7 years we've just lived through, which can be thought of as an era of global pessimism, with a kind of focus on sources of global insecurity, which lead us to a period which is about to now begin next month. Maybe it's already begun. The post-Cold War era. And it's a period of managing global insecurity of all kinds, which pose new threats to human rights. So the question is, how do we have a politics of implementing human rights in this post-Cold War era? Now, in the era of universalization, and this is picking up on some of the themes that Claudio mentioned, the major accomplishment was the universalization of human rights norms, the rhetorical acceptance of those norms by so many international actors. It started even before the Universal Declaration with the 4 Freedoms Speech in 1941, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, freedom from fear, really set a blueprint for the treaty framework that followed. Freedom of speech and religion, International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, freedom from want, economic, social, and cultural rights, freedom from fear, the Genocide Convention, the Refugee Convention. And then Dumbarton Oaks in 1944 put this framework into the New World Order, adopted in the Universal Declaration and then also at San Francisco in the UN Charter, which mentions observance of human rights, fundamental freedoms for all, the birth of international humanitarian law, particularly Geneva Conventions and the Refugee Convention. At the same time, Nuremberg and the first birth of international criminal adjudication at Nuremberg and also the Tokyo tribunals, some of the basic premises laid down that non-state actors can commit genocide, that command responsibility can be punished, and that you cannot cite a superior order's defense. And then a vertical link between democracy, constitutional democracy, and the universal human rights movement. So this period from 1941 to roughly 56 was important because of the wide-scale acceptance of these universal norms, which is why I call it the era of universalization. But what needed to get it going was institutions who would actually work to implement these universal norms. And in the next 20 years, you have the UN bodies, ECOSOC, the Human Rights Commission, the treaty bodies, the Human Rights Committee, the Committee Against Torture, on which Claudio is the chair, the regional processes, Strasbourg, Helsinki, the Council of Europe, the OSCE, the Inter-American system, in which this law school has played such an important role, sometimes we call it the Inter-American School of Law, and of course, non-governmental organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights Now, Human Rights First. And then it was really in the late 70s and 80s that the norms and the institutions started to work together in this transnational legal process we've described. I call this the era of operationalization, in which different systems, regional, national systems of national adjudication, the rise of NGO activities, started to give compliance pull and traction to these norms, not just through the Jimmy Carter period and the creation of human rights bodies at the State Department, including the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, which I was privileged to serve, domestic litigation, for example, the Florida and Alien Tort Claims Act line of cases, a surge of NGO activity. And so the machines started to function. Institutions operationalizing the universal norms in various settings, legislative, judicial, and executive. And this led to this period of global optimism I've described in the collapse of the Berlin Wall, where people felt that really pretty much anything was possible. The spread of freedom in many, many countries of the world, the revival of international criminal adjudication in the Yugoslav Tribunal, Rwanda, the framing of the International Criminal Court, the effort by regional systems to address regional conflict, sometimes unsuccessfully, as in Rwanda and Bosnia, sometimes more successfully, and a revival of U.S. human rights policy during the Clinton administration, with notable failures, but nevertheless some concerted effort. And then you have the period that followed, the period through which we've just lived, an unusually bleak period, in which the United States put itself in a very different posture. People became extremely skeptical about the possibilities of globalization. The tools of globalization, which were viewed with such optimism, were suddenly viewed as part of the threat. The internet could be used to organize terrorist campaigns. The monetary system could be used to finance terrorist strikes, even the instruments of global travel. Airplanes could be used as weapons. And then this brought us into the period we're about to enter now, where we see ourselves as subject to various kinds of global insecurity, and the question is, how do we manage that global insecurity? And what I'd like to suggest is that in the last 8 years, there has been a dramatic inversion of our foreign policy vision. In September 2001, obviously, not always complied with, but the idea of universal human rights based on the four freedoms of speech, the notion that democracy promotion should occur from the bottom up, diplomacy should be used instead of force, a diplomatic approach, which some have called strategic multilateralism and tactical unilateralism, an effort to promote global cooperation among global democracies to solve global problems by using mechanisms of international law and institutions, and a belief that in important respects, as the Supreme Court said in the case of Obama case, international law is part of our law. Today, we see that in fact this vision has been turned upside down. Increasingly, we have argued for double standards in human rights, not universal standards, treating law-free zones like Guantanamo, law-free practices like extraordinary rendition, law-free courts like military commissions, law-free persons we call enemy combatants. The overriding value has been freedom from fear. Democracy policy has been accompanied by military force, with the attendant difficulties we faced in both Iraq and Afghanistan. A diplomatic approach which focuses on unilateralism as a preferred mechanism, leading to the accompanying antipathy to international law. And then, quite extraordinarily to me, an effort by academics and lawyers to suggest that the ordinary effort to integrate domestic and international law is itself a form of lawfare, an illegitimate response to the war on terror. So take, for example, Jack Goldsmith. He's a student of mine. He's a person who has played quite a heroic role in many respects in this administration in resisting some of the worst features of the attack on the rule of law. But nevertheless, look in his book, which is about this, chapter 2, The Commander-in-Chief Ensnared by Law. Now, I can't get over this title. I thought the Commander-in-Chief was a creature of law. I thought the Commander-in-Chief exists only because of law. And then the statement, globalization of more conservative Supreme Court motivated many in the academic American left, I think that includes many here in this law school, to replace the Constitution with international human rights laws, the founts of progressivism. And more than that, in the past quarter century, various nations, NGOs, academics, international organizations, and others in the international community have been weaving a vast conspiracy, a web of international law and judicial institutions that threatens U.S. government interests. Unless we tackle the problem head on, it will continue to grow. Law is the problem under this theory. It's not part of the solution. And then we have three famous black eyes debacles. You all know them. Abu Ghraib. When I testified before the Committee Against Torture in 1999, I said in part of my testimony on behalf of the State Department that the United States was unalterably opposed to the use of torture as an instrument of state policy, and that we saw no circumstance under which torture would ever be justified as a policy, and that those who committed it would be punished. Now, that was not a casual statement. It was something that was cleared with every governmental bureau. There was nobody I knew in the U.S. government who made a serious argument that torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment was a legitimate instrument of state policy. And yet we see the famous picture in Abu Ghraib, having had the misfortune to visit many torture dens in the late 90s, the first thing that occurred to me when I saw this was that the people who organized this were not doing it on their own. 19-year-old privates from West Virginia, they were trained. Somebody trained them. These are established techniques. Yet those who trained them have not been punished. And we have low-level prosecutions. Military investigations have produced few punishments. We have euphemistic definitions of torture and extreme practices. And then, shockingly, in many circles, some accepted that torture is inevitable and necessary. Jack Bauer, I enjoy the television show. I watched the prequel the other night. Nevertheless, those of you who know Jane Mayer and her book on the dark side, Now more than 100 torture scenes a year, regularly U.S. government officials depicted as committing war crimes. And whether that's true or not, this is the most exported show to Morocco and Egypt, which clearly sends a message to an audience that we're trying to bring to our side about what we consider to be a normal governmental practice. And then, of course, the tragedy of Guantanamo. Here's a short listing of the numbers. More suicides than pending cases. High security facilities in the hundreds of millions. And then an amazing fact that the current president, Secretary of Defense, who will continue to be Attorney General, 8 Democratic presidential candidates, 2 Republicans, all of our leading allies say it should be closed. And nevertheless, even to this day, we're reading in the papers about how hard that will be, that something which everybody recognizes as a disaster somehow is difficult or too difficult to undo. Now, the impact on our global reputation is well known. Pew Global Attitude Study shows a decline in our reputation in even our 15 closest allies. Our image declines even in countries that share common concerns. Now 85% of Germans believe that Guantanamo is illegal, 65% of the Brits. That in 1998, the Germans, 61%, thought we were doing a good job on human rights leadership. Now almost 80% thinking we're doing a bad job. Similar numbers from the UK and others. And even the critics of lawfare recognize this. The same book I cited earlier says, in the war on terror, the President Bush has been inattentive to expression of public concern for public constitutional and international values, and thus our hard power has diminished. But somehow not seeing the connection between this loss of soft power and our lack of respect for human rights and legal values. So the question then is, what should we now do? We're now in a new moment. And it seems to me that the most important thing is that we not see ourselves as so exhausted in resisting what has gone to this point that we don't fight hard in the next period. The fact of the matter is the next 8 years are much more important than the last 8, because they will determine whether the pendulum pushed so far in one direction so fast will get pushed back. And secondly, it's clear, because of all the other items that have pushed their way onto the agenda, that we simply can no longer allow our foreign policy framework to be subsumed under the war on terror. Here are just some obvious issues: economy, energy, climate change, a whole series of regional issues, democracy, relations with international bodies. This cannot be treated as simply one more manifestation of the war on terror. On the other hand, we can't simply go back to the future. The world has dramatically changed. We live now in an age of globalization. Tom Friedman calls it hot, flat, and crowded. The nation state's power declining. The rise of what some have called network power. The proliferation of global insecurity in all areas. And an incompletely globalized system of governance and rights and institutions, which leave the need for American leadership as the most powerful nation. And so what we need now, and this is the theme of these remarks, is a politics of implementation to restore the role of human rights in our foreign policy, a strategy for managing our common insecurity that combines what nation states exercising responsible sovereignty, not just within their own territories, but also outside. Genuine multilateral cooperation, as well as cooperation between the legislative and executive branches. Some leadership from the new administration and support from Congress, and collective action by NGOs where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Now, what does this mean concretely? Because I really do want to leave a concrete message, and it seems to me there are 4 steps. The administration, at least in the early days, seems ready to pursue all 4. And those are in the right sequence. And I think that they should think boldly. But there are some which are short-term and some are long-term. First and most obviously, restoring our moral standing by putting our house back in order. That's critical to regaining respect for our respect for values. assembling the resources for renewed engagement through diplomacy, renewing our respect for international law and institutions, and then relaunching a whole series of global initiatives which have laid fallow for the last 8 years. And President-elect Obama has said, as recently as on 60 Minutes, interestingly, in contrast to many, he simply repeated, "I intend to close Guantanamo, I'll follow through, America doesn't torture, and make sure we don't torture, part and parcel of our effort to regain America's moral stature in the world." So he sees things, or at least as he has described it thus far, as more straightforward than many of those people who are worried about the details. He says, "We will maintain the highest standards of civil liberties and human rights, which is why I'll close Guantanamo, restore Haiti, say no to torture, and also move on other issues as well, the devastation of HIV, AIDS, genocide in Darfur." Now, it seems to me that putting our own house back in order has at least five elements. And many of these have been discussed by others, but I hope to put them together into a package. This part, I think, can be done very soon, now. They should be working on it now. Closing Guantanamo, undoing the system of perceived injustice, a series of executive orders that could be issued in the first weeks of the new administration, bringing national security legislation to the fore and addressing the question of immigration reform. You have yesterday, the national security team announced the most important thing is that there be coordinated action among these individuals. The transition cannot operate in a stovepipe manner. There is a negative precedent, which is, frankly, the Clinton administration's maintenance of its Guantanamo and refoulement policies with regard to Haitian refugees came about in large part because they did not solve the problem during the transition. And once they started to own it, once they defended before the Supreme Court, then they had less and less of an incentive to actually change it. It seems to me that the positive precedent came in 1980 when the Reagan administration, incoming, worked very closely with the Carter administration and achieved a release of the Iranian hostages on Inauguration Day, which means that the new Attorney General should appoint a point person to deal collectively with Guantanamo, to decide, as the CSIS and others have suggested, that we figure out which detainees should be prosecuted, which should be repatriated, which should be resettled, that incoming attorneys to the White House Counsel's Office and the Justice Department and the Defense Department read and withdraw classified legal opinions, which are clearly illegal. The military commission's proceedings should be suspended. The fact of the matter is the first military commission's proceeding will happen on January 25th. If they wait till inauguration to figure it out and jeopardy attaches, they cannot prosecute under any alternative method. And then the latest rumor mill that the transition team is considering an incredibly bad idea put forward by many people who style themselves as part of the realist group with regards to the war on terror, of creating national security courts or a system of preventive detention. Anyone you should speak to, please tell them that this is an incredibly bad idea. For the simple reason that does anybody seriously believe that if these courts could be created and if they prosecuted someone, that in the Middle East, anybody would believe that that's credible justice, a special court for Muslims? If it's accompanied by preventive detention, then you are essentially creating groups of people together, much as the Northern Irish were held during a period of the Diplock courts. It had a tremendous effect in terms of recruiting membership to the IRA, and it will inevitably be viewed as a secret ad hoc court based on racial profiling. It's such a bad idea. It's amazing how many people are pushing this forward, and many of them people who are not focused on what an incredible error it would be to start a new administration with this step. On executive orders, a number of things obviously in the mix. Any number of groups have been drafting executive orders banning torture and cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment, including waterboarding. Clarification of the authorization of use of military force, resolution to clarify that it's not a blank check. establishing a national security law committee that will do a better job than the last administration did of reviewing national security legal opinions. On the question of accountability, the formation of some kind of independent commission to look into the past and report accurately on it, forswearing efforts to avoid habeas by moving detainees to black sites. This is a key message of the Boumediene decision, is that you cannot merely by moving someone to some place outside the United States territorial borders like Guantanamo, take away someone's constitutional right to habeas corpus. And then longer term national security legislation of various kinds, revising the Classified Information Procedures Act. The administration needs, I think, to look back at the foreign intelligence surveillance situation now that they have some time. But most important, Congress needs to start legislating again with actual hearings and actually taking time to hear from people rather than tacking things on to writers and doing things at the as part of an appropriation process. Now, we have here Janet Napolitano, named yesterday as the head of Homeland Security. The fact of the matter is that Homeland Security needs to be not the central point on immigration issues, in that there are many sets of immigration and integration measures that are not part of Homeland Security. They're part of building a new nation. And at a time when we've just elected a president who does not look like your average American president, it's a time for us to be expanding our vision of what it means to be an American. We should focus on providing immigration due process, simplifying the immigration system to create better visa classifications in the global legal framework, moving toward, in time, revamping the refugee framework of the 1951 Convention for the 21st century. The next phase, once you get through this early list, which is really, as I say, just putting our house back in order, is assembling the resources for renewed diplomatic engagement. And here I think Hillary Clinton is a person who's well suited for this task. She will get easily confirmed. She has credibility with her Senate colleagues. What has been ill noticed over the last period is the tremendous militarization of diplomacy that has occurred in the last 7-8 years with the Pentagon and various and DOD receiving a disproportionate amount of funding, the reduction of civil-military relations. And the question is how to build up the resources, because the tools that the new State Department will need is primarily diplomacy. We don't have enough troops. However, Hillary Clinton does have the capacity to put in the field as a force multiplier Bill Clinton, Dennis Ross, Chris Hill, Joe Biden, Richard Holbrooke, and that herself. And that is creates an enormous set of possibilities in places that need diplomatic efforts and the creation of new international law structures, whether in the Middle East, Kashmir, North Korea, or other places. Third, renewed respect for international law and institutions. There are many things that could be said here. I think the International Criminal Court is an important area to signal a return to promotion of accountability through positive engagement, a new policy of positive engagement. The Holocaust Museum Prevention Task Force will shortly announce a new Genocide Prevention Task Force report. Motion on Darfur, which has laid fallow for the last few years while atrocities have occurred, and re-engaging with international law and international mechanism. The International Criminal Court, I think, is an extraordinary situation. The Bush administration declared war on the court, so they wanted it to die. Now, without people really paying that much attention, they moved to a situation of accepting the reality of the ICC. There has been a referral on Darfur supported by the U.S., passive support for prosecutions in Congo and Uganda, a Sierra Leone tribunal, the prosecution of Charles Taylor's son in the U.S. court, progress on Cambodia. The State Department legal advisor says we've accepted the reality of the ICC, yet our formal position is still controlled by a letter sent by John Bolton in 2002. And my view of this is, and I asked somebody recently about this issue, they said, there has been a change of nuance in our policy. And I said, yes, 180-degree change of nuance. Why don't you simply signal right now even before the end of this administration, that the policy is no longer one of hostility, it's one of positive engagement, leading over time to re-signature and ratification, but that those steps should be taken and we should look for ways to remove obstacles to that result. On Darfur, many have written, I think many agree, the four P's, the peace process, peacekeepers, protection of refugees and internally displaced, punishing of perpetrators, and then step four, which is broader initiation of various forms of global initiatives in the financial area beyond the G20, a green agenda with binding carbon caps, re-engaging on climate change, greater sensitivity to developmental consequences, loose nukes, a problem with great concern to Senator Obama, a restoration of focus on the Millennium Development Goals, regional engagement, which has pretty much died over the last years, obviously with China and Russia, which have maintained extraordinary focus, India and Pakistan in the wake of Mumbai, but also Latin America, about which I'll say more, and the promotion of private public partnerships. Now, there's been a lot of negative talk about Bill Clinton's role. The fact of the matter is that we now have a Secretary of State who has a capacity to launch a private public initiative of an extraordinary scale with the help of someone who has his own foundation and global recognition. And so it may well be that we see an unprecedented amount of public-private activity in areas like corporate social responsibility, stopping of blood, resources, internet freedom, et cetera. For this law school, I think it's equally important that we focus on the Western Hemisphere, free trade, of course, addressing the problem countries, Venezuela and Cuba, not abandoning Haiti, pursuit of accountability in Peru for Fujimori, a rethinking of Plan Colombia, ratification of the American Convention, other kinds of multilateral strategies. So what are the dangers? And here are some obvious ones. First, and I think perhaps the most greatest danger may well be this idea that it's going to take so long to unwind what the Bush administration put in place. That's a lot of the approach on Guantanamo. The truth of it is that Gordian knots are to be cut, not untied, and that dramatic steps are to be taken, and especially if the need for early action so that you jettison an albatross with which you'll otherwise be stuck. Now, perhaps on Guantanamo there's problems with Yemen or other countries. Envoy dispatch now could simply say to them, if you want to ever meet Barack Obama, you might want to make some decisions before January 21st. If Barack Obama goes to Africa, there are 44 sub-Saharan African countries, and he can only visit about 8 of them in 5 days. And those 8 could well be the ones who are helpful. And I don't think you should underestimate the power that this individual has around the world. They should exercise that diplomatic power and leverage and not be afraid. Now, somebody said to me from the outgoing administration, the Europeans will never help us. And I said, the Europeans will never help Bush. But 200,000 people did not go to the Tiergarten in Berlin to celebrate the continuation of the policies of the last 7 years. Now, there's obviously a problem with avoiding early failures and stalemates. This is the problem of the Clinton administration. A lot of that was simply disorganization. We see impressive organization at this point. A even greater concern, crisis overload between the economy and Iraq. The problem of insufficient resources, uncoordinated messages. Two powerful individuals like the President and the Secretary of State, there could well be struggles. But I think the main thing is for people not to get captured in the idea that now is not the timeism. After all, the last administration did not hesitate to push change. And so the new administration should be equally willing, with the support and pushing of its civil society advocates, to say, let's not retreat from that change agenda. And I think the challenges of the administration and Congress, obviously number one, walking and chewing gum at the same time. I do think it's significant that when one candidate suspended his campaign to solve the financial crisis, and you may have noticed that it didn't get solved. The other candidate who won the election said, well, the fact of the matter is the president has to be able to do more than one thing at the same time. And addressing both the urgent and the important, but using the sense of urgency and consensus on issues on which there's strong bipartisan agreement to develop a political modus vivendi, building momentum over time that enables effective attack on some of these more serious global problems. What should civil society do? The NGOs, many of them represented here. Obviously, you can't do this without the right people in government in the right positions, helping them to get the resources. If they do the right thing, give them credit. And if they do the wrong thing, then criticize them. Providing expertise, identifying possible policy solutions. I noticed that when I was in the government, if you say the NGOs will criticize us, that has almost no influence. If you say, I've heard it predicted that if we do this, this will happen, which is a disaster, then people do listen to that. So to treat this as a form of prediction, not criticism, more fora for public-private dialogue and building constituencies for change. I spoke at a conference a few weeks ago, and someone got up and said, I like what you're saying, but there is no constituency for this change. There is no constituency. I said, you know, when Barack Obama announced for president, there's no constituency for electing a president. He just happened to build one through a variety of mechanisms, and you ought to see that it's possible that it can be done. So I think the 4 years ahead will be a tale of three globalizations: the globalization of governance, the globalization of freedom, but at the same time, the globalization of the fear that comes from various kinds of global insecurity. And the challenge will be how to use the first two to address the third. Now, a new president is key, but I think we have to remember that this is much too important to leave to politicians who are subject, obviously, to political pressures. It's a challenge for all of us. It's something that civil society, those of us here, must do. And I think most important, we should remember that ours is a country which was created to secure the blessings of liberty and to support the protection of certain inalienable rights. There is no other country in the world that is so fundamentally defined by its commitment to human rights and law, which means that if we don't stand for those principles after the last 8 years, we really are a country that doesn't know who we are anymore. And that's the thing that must be reclaimed, developing a 21st century politics of implementation for human rights. And as Eleanor Roosevelt said every night, in an age of global insecurity, saving us from ourselves and showing us a vision of a world made new. This is something I think that the Universal Declaration, as an aspirational document, as well as one now tested by 60 years, you read it and it feels fresh. It's still calling for a world made new. The optimism is high. There will be moments in which it's tempered by realities. But I think that that power of this instrument is something that we should maintain. Thank you.
We'll continue in 4 minutes. Thank you for the recognition. At 2 o'clock, we reconvene in the main room.